Welcome back. Today we're going to be talking about The Lonely Hearts Killers. The Raymond Martinez Fernandez and Martha Jewel Beck. They were American serial killers. They were convicted of one murder and are known to have committed two more, and were suspected of having killed up to 20 victims during a span between 1947 and 49. So there's a number of books, movies based off of this particular couple that killed. I guess it's a serial killing couple.
Yeah.
You should say serial killing couple.
Yeah. We're trying that out to see how people like it, to see if they like the serial killer couples.
Give you some background here. Raymond Martinez Fernandez. Raymond Martinez Fernandez.
Okay, I'm just going to put it out there. I'm not saying that every time.
You just want to go with Ray?
Raymond's fine, but I'm not. I'm just not good with some names.
Okay, I mean, it's okay if you're racist.
I'm not racist, I just...
You have trouble with the Spanish, eh?
I have... Oh my God, no. Ass. Some words I just can't say.
Okay. Anyway, Raymond Martinez Fernandez was born on December 17th, 1914... he was born in Hawaii to Spanish parents. They shortly there moved to Bridgeport, Connecticut. As a teenager, he went to work on his uncle's farm, which was located in Spain, and he married a local woman there in Spain. I'm going to try the name.
See what I'm saying?
Encarnacion Robles, and they got married at the age of 20 and had four children. Sadly, but not surprisingly, he abandoned all four of those children later in life. After serving in the Spain's Merchant Marine and then British Intelligence during World War II, Ray decided to seek work. Shortly after boarding a ship that was coming to the U.S., a steel hatch fell on him, fracturing his skull and injuring his frontal lobe. Uh-oh, I can already see where this is going.
So he was normal before that.
That's what they're saying. The damage caused by this injury may well have affected his social and sexual behavior. Okay. Upon his release from the hospital, Fernandez, or Ray, stole some clothing and was subsequently imprisoned for a year. During this time, his cellmate had converted him into believing in the voodoo and black magic. He later claimed that black magic gave him irresistible power and charm over women. Okay.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Okay, some background on Martha Beck. She was born Martha Jewel Seabrook on May 6th of 1920 in Milton, Florida. Allegedly due to a glandular problem, that's what they used to call obese people. That's what they would say.
Or big boned.
Or, yeah. I mean, that's just what they called it back then.
You got a glandular issue.
She was
glands are huge.
She was overweight and underwent puberty prematurely. That doesn't make sense.
Maybe. I don't know.
At her trial, she claimed to have been raped by her brother. She went on to claim that when she had told her mother what had happened, her mother had beaten her, claiming that Martha was responsible. Well, that's just great.
It's a good mom.
As a teen, right? As a teen, Martha ran away from home to join a traveling circus. You know, you hear people say that all the time, but I didn't know people actually did it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it seems like she had something to offer.
And come here, Hades. In 1978, writer Truman Capote said that he had also joined her for a short time when he was 10. After Martha finished school, how did she go to school if she was in the traveling circus?
I don't know.
Maybe the circus people had tutors. Who knows? After Martha finished school, she studied nursing but had trouble finding a job due to her weight. That's horrible. She wants to do something, but they won't hire her because she's overweight. And in the 20s and 30s, overweight, you don't know. Overweight then is probably not what overweight is now.
Yeah, I would think that overweight, because I know that a lot of the females that were curvy.
Because there's pictures of her. I mean, she doesn't look as heavy as what they're trying to say she was.
I think they just didn't want to hire her because she's fucking weird.
Well, that could have been too. She initially became an undertaker's assistant and prepared female bodies for burial. Jesus Christ.
So we were already setting her up. She had a bad mom. Now she's in
She's saying her brother raped her. That's just, I can't. I don't know that I can do that. She then quit that job and moved to California, where she worked in an army hospital as a nurse. While living in California as a hospital nurse, she eventually became pregnant. She tried to convince the father to marry her, but he refused.
Because she was fat?
It's probably, you know, some guys will have the chicks that they'll have sex with but won't be seen with. Yeah,
and she's a fat weirdo.
Right.
Whatever. Probably a good blowjob.
Oh, my God. Well, seeing no one pregnant, she moved to Florida. Martha told the people there that the father was a serviceman she had married, later claiming he had been killed in the Pacific campaign. Because even then, very frowned upon to have a baby and not be married. You had to make stories up.
Yeah.
The town mourned her loss, and the story was published in the local newspaper. Shortly after her daughter was born, she became pregnant again by a Pensacola bus driver named Alfred Beck.
For a fat weirdo, she's getting a lot of dick.
Seriously.
I mean, you know, she's not doing too bad for herself in that department, apparently.
Right? They married quickly and divorced 6 months thereafter, and she gave birth to a son. Now she's unemployed, and she's the single mother of two children. Beck escaped into a fantasy world, buying romance magazines and novels and watching romantic movies. In 1946, she found employment in the Pensacola Hospital for Children. She then placed a Lonely Hearts ad in 1947, which Raymond answered.
Aw, and love is born.
Well, something's born. I don't necessarily know if it's love.
Fernandez actually visited Beck and stayed for a short time, I guess, after contacting about the
Lonely Hearts ad.
Yeah. She told everyone they were to be married. He returned to New York City, where she made preparations in Florida. Now that's where she had lived. When she was abruptly fired from her job, she packed up and arrived on his doorstep in New York. That's a little soon, isn't it? What the fuck? Right?
Okay, well, think about it. Between them, they have, what, 6 kids?
Yeah. Fernandez enjoyed the way she catered to his every whim.
Okay, well, if she's as overweight as they're saying, she probably would have felt like, just because he's paying attention to her and is staying in one spot long enough, she'd have to cater to him to make him stay.
Apparently, yeah. I mean, and when he learned she had left her children for him, he thought it was a sign of unconditional love.
I was going to ask what happened to her kids.
He confessed his criminal enterprises to Beck, who quickly sent her children to the Salvation Army in order to assist Fernandez without any hindrance. She posed as Fernandez's sister, giving him an air of respectability. Their victims, feeling more secure and knowing that there was another woman in the house, often agreed to stay with the pair. Beck also convinced some of the victims that she lived alone and that her brother was only a guest. Beck was extremely jealous and went to great lengths to make sure Fernandez and his intended never consummated their relationship. And when he did have sex with a woman, Beck subjugated both to her violent temper.
Okay, well, what does she think he's bringing these women in for?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that would be the question, like, why you gotta have another bitch? Hey, what's going on? You know, and maybe, I know with some of these folks where the killer was actually married to somebody, they took out all their violent fantasies on the people they abducted because they did not want to hurt the spouse. So the spouse allowed it because it's happening to them, not to me.
Right.
So I don't know what was in her head. In 1949, the pair committed 3 murders, for which they were later convicted. Janet Fay, 66, became engaged to Fernandez and went to stay at his Long Island apartment. When Beck caught her in bed with Fernandez, she brutally attacked Fay's head with a hammer in a murderous rage. Fernandez then strangled Fay. Fay's family became suspicious when she disappeared, and Fernandez and Beck fled.
She beat the bitch with a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So why then did she have to be strangled? Because I would have thought the hammer would have done it.
Maybe it was part of her rage. She needed to go through that whole process. You know, sometimes the hammer's not enough. Beck and Fernandez traveled to Byron Center Road in Wyoming Township, Michigan, a suburb of Grand Rapids, where they met and stayed with Delphine Downing, a 28-year-old widow with a 2-year-old daughter. On February 28th, Downing became agitated, and Fernandez gave her sleeping pills to calm her. That's right. That should happen.
Right.
The daughter witnessed Downing's resulting stupor and began to cry, which enraged Beck. Panicked, Beck choked the child, but didn't kill her. Just, you know, a little choke, hey, is what I can do. Fernandez thought Downing would become suspicious if she saw the bruised daughter, so he shot the unconscious woman. The couple then stayed for several days in Downing's house. Again enraged by the daughter's crying, Beck drowned her in a basin of water. They buried the bodies in the basement, but suspicious neighbors reported the Downing's disappearances, leading police to arrive at the door on March 1st, 1949, and they arrested both Beck and Fernandez.
After they were arrested, Fernandez quickly confessed, because what can you do?
Right.
The pair vehemently denied committing 17 murders that were attributed to them. And Fernandez tried to retract his confession, saying he made it up only to protect Beck. Their trial, of course, was sensationalized with lurid tales of sexual perversity. Newspaper reporters describes Beck's appearance with... I guess they just explained it really bad because she was very homely and overweight.
Yeah, with derision.
And she wrote protesting letters to the editors. Fernandez and Beck were convicted of Janet Fay's murder, the only one for which they were tried and sentenced to death. They were both executed on March 8th, 1951.
Yeah, look at these pictures, though. Kind of rough.
Well, yeah, I mean, she wasn't like the
I guess that where they served their time was Sing Sing Prison in New York. And I guess that this was something that they come up with to scheme, seduce, rob, and murder women who placed personal ads in the newspaper.
Then where they got the lonely hearts.
Beck and Fernandez both boasted to killing as many as 17 women in this manner, but evidence suggests that there may have only been 4 victims. By all reports, they say Martha, and I don't know if I agree, it seems like they're trashing her a little bit. She was overweight, unattractive. I don't know what that has to do with anything, but she had joined the Lonely Hearts Club and advertised a romance magazine.
And Fernandez was actually the first person to answer, but apparently he had been on there for a while. Because he dated older women until he gained enough of their trust. And then, of course, big surprise, he would loot bank accounts, steal their money.
I guess after his injury in World War II, he suffered a serious head injury that left him bald with serious headaches. And then he became a petty criminal and wore cheap black toupees. He convinced himself that he had power over women and could turn them into sexual slaves. Why is that a theme? Why is that a theme a lot? I mean, with these serial killers.
I don't know.
I'm gonna turn him into a sexual slave, you know, just to do whatever I want him to do. I don't understand the attraction to that. So Fernandez found his mark in the Lonely Hearts Club. So he trolled that. Almost like your modern day internet troll, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He dated the older women until he gained enough of her trust to loot her bank account. The next year, he then took the latest in a line of victims to Spain, where she had turned up dead in a hotel room.
Which, of course, he didn't do.
Right. Fernandez did respond to Beck's note with the intention of conning her, but after a brief affair, Fernandez and Beck apparently fell in love. When he confessed the original idea, Beck did like his scheme so much that she decided to join him. I think she was just wanting to be accepted.
Yeah, I think she was just lonely, obviously, because she joined a Lonely Hearts Club. Right. But
she had that built-up rage from all the... It sounds like she had some mental problems to begin with, but I think also it was because, I mean, she was made fun of, it sounds like. People were describing her.
Mom and if she was, nice. Right, and if she was, in fact, raped by her brother, her mother blamed her for it, so that can't do much for the self-confidence.
So that was the scheme, though. Beck did pose as Fernandez's sister.
For 2 years, she did.
Mm-hmm. And then, as he seduced the older women, they would then steal from them. It is confirmed by 49 that they did murder the one victim and killed another accidentally with sleeping pills. I guess the end did come when Fernandez hooked up with a younger woman in Michigan. The woman was a bit suspicious of the brother and sister duo, and although she allowed them to move into her home, wouldn't marry Fernandez immediately and provide him access to her funds. When the jealous Beck got tired of waiting, the pair killed the woman and her 2-year-old daughter and buried them both in the basement. Police officers, challenged by Fernandez himself, searched the home and found the makeshift graves. Beck and Fernandez confessed readily in the belief that their lives were safe in the non-capital punishment state of Michigan, but they didn't count on being extradited to New York, where the electric chair was awaiting them. At the last minute, they attempted the insanity defense, but were unable to convince the jury. And I guess in 1969, there was a movie made called The Honeymoon Killers.
It's based on them. That's pretty much, there's not a whole lot on them, really. But we have another one we can do.
Yeah.
To add to this one, it's not the same type, but it's another couple serial killing group.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, I'll let you.
This one, they were called the San Francisco Witch Killers.
Okay.
It was Michael Bear Carson and Susan Carson. They obviously were active in the San Francisco Bay Area between 81 and 83. Background.
In 1977, James Carson was in the Phoenix, Arizona, when his first wife noticed some severe behavioral changes and left with their daughter. Motherfucker, you're weird. We're gone, pretty much. Jennifer Carson began a relationship with Susan Barnes, a divorcee with 2 teenage sons. James and Susan then married and became involved in illicit drugs and mysticism.
It's always.
I know. It's
the last one, I mean, he was in the black magic.
Yep, and it made him irresistible despite his cheap toupee. It made him irresistible to the other person who was rejected by society, apparently. At some point, Carson took the name Michael Bear, telling his daughter in a letter that God had given him the new name Michael. Susan became known as Susan Bear.
And here we go, with God telling people what to do.
By 1980, after a year-long trip to Europe, the Carsons returned to the U.S. and moved into the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood of San Francisco, California. They continued their involvement with drugs and the counterculture. By this time, Michael's former wife had become afraid that he would harm her and try to abduct the child. She took steps to hide herself and the child from him. She went so far as to move numerous times and cut off contact with their mutual acquaintances.
Probably not a bad idea.
No, he sounds already like a little crazy.
Run away.
Right, just, you know, it's one of those things where you look at the situation and say, I don't think this motherfucker's going to get any better.
No.
I think it's just going to go downhill, and I don't think he's going to take his lithium or his Depakote. Or his other medications that he needs to be saving.
Was that stuff even around in the 80s?
Yeah. I'm not sure that he was prescribed it, but it sounds like he needed to be. So.
In March 1981, 23-year-old Kieran Barnes, an aspiring actress from Georgia, who had been the Carsons' roommate in San Francisco, was found dead in their shared apartment. Wonder who did that. She had been stabbed 13 times and her skull crushed before being wrapped in a blanket and hidden in the basement. Evidence suggested Kieran had been killed by someone she knew, and the Carsons became the prime suspects, because why not? They're all in the same place at the same time. However, the family disappeared before the body was found. The Carsons later confessed to killing Kieran after Susan had decided she was a witch. The Carsons fled to a mountain hideout near Grants Pass, Oregon, where they remained until the spring of 1982. They then moved to Alder Point, California, where they lived and worked on a marijuana farm.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, didn't we watch something about that, and it's really not as much fun as you would think it is?
Yeah, it was, what was it, Killer Mountain or something like that?
Yeah. Not that much fun. According to the other workers on the farm, the Carsons were anarchists who advocated revolution and predicted that a nuclear apocalypse would soon occur. Wow. If there was an apocalypse or a doomsday thing for every person that said that, the world would have ended like 100 years ago.
The world always is going to end with some group or some people. They're always preparing for the worst.
Well, just think about that.
They have a fatalistic view.
That one bitch that killed her kids. What world was supposed to end in July, according to her?
In May 1982, Michael shot and killed Clark Stevens, a worker on the farm with whom he had a dispute, and attempted to dispose of the body by burning it and burying it under chicken fertilizer in the woods. We had learned from Making a Murderer that it has to burn so hot for it to actually turn the bones into ash. Like, the fire has to be that hot, and most people don't get the fire that hot.
Well, you can't, because you can't just burn a body at a farm or something like that. That's why I'm not entirely convinced that he killed that chick, but that's another story. That's why you have to do, like, bodies have to, nowadays, have to be burned at a crematorium, because they have the supplies that they need. But when people used to make funeral pyres, they had so much wood that they would put the bodies on, and they obviously knew how to do it to make it burn hot enough, but it would take, I think, like the entirety of the day.
Yeah, I mean, it really has to be a certain temperature for so long.
They had to keep adding wood to it. And then, of course, they would just, after the body had, in fact, burned and all the ashes were left, they just left it there for the wind to then blow the ashes away.
Yeah. 2 weeks later, Stevens was reported missing to the Humboldt County Sheriff, leading to the discovery of Stevens' burnt remains. See?
Yeah, they were still there.
They're still bones.
Yeah.
The Carsons, who by this point had fled, were again considered suspects. Upon searching their abandoned belongings, detectives found a manifesto they had written. Why are they always writing fucking manifestos now? You just see that something else. Let's just write it all down. These are people that actually believe this shit. Like, I'm going to write a fucking manifesto, or I'm going to videotape everything that I did. That way, when I get caught, I'm sure to be convicted. What the fuck?
Well, they also do it because they think that by writing the manifesto and doing all this crap and making it, you know, documenting it, other people will join what they're trying to do.
Well, yes, because his manifesto the manifesto they had written called for the assassination of then President Ronald Reagan.
Didn't somebody try to assassinate Reagan?
They did try to. But the authorities had difficulty tracking down the Carsons. In 1982, Michael was picked up by the police in Los Angeles after an acquaintance saw him hitchhiking. However, get this, you hear this a lot, through police error.
Big surprise.
Carson was quickly freed and vanished before Humboldt County detectives had a chance to question him. He left evidence behind, including a mugshot, address information, and a gun that was left in a police car.
Wow.
The following January, the Carsons were hitchhiking near Bakersfield and were given a ride by 30-year-old John Charles Hellyer, who was driving to Santa Rosa. Susan reportedly decided that Hellyer was a witch and had to be killed. So,
Jesus Christ.
Oh my God, are we back in Salem? While he was driving on U.S. Route 101, an argument and physical fight broke out between Hellyer and the Carsons, resulting in the car coming to a stop. That's right. I ain't a fucking witch. What the fuck? Get out.
Right.
The fight escalated outside the vehicle. Susan stabbed Hellyer while he and Michael struggled over a gun. Michael got control of the gun, killed Hellyer in the view of passing motorists, one of whom contacted the police. A high-speed chase ensued, and the Carsons attempted to flee. But they crashed Hellyer's car and were apprehended.
It's not a surprise.
Okay, you didn't know he was a witch before you got in the car? Right? Like, I would have been, like, if I was Michael, I'd have been like, hey, bitch. Like, you couldn't tell me that was a witch before we got in the car. Why did we get in the car? Like, I have to question your validity. Like, you didn't know?
Well,
now you know? Like, how do you know now and you didn't know then?
But, I mean, to be fair, he doesn't seem sane himself. Doesn't seem like he needs to be talked into killing anybody.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just, like, hey, maybe that's information we need to share before we get in the fucking car.
Well, what all of a sudden made her think that her roommate was a witch? How long had they lived together? And then she's like, all of a sudden, bitch, you're a witch. I gotta kill you.
Just seems like maybe she just makes excuses that people are witches because she doesn't like them.
And then she's using the internet as an excuse to kill them.
Like the Salem witch trials. Actually, that was an excuse for them to rape and torture people to get the rocks off. But whatever.
Right. Carsons initially called a press conference to confess to the murders of Hellyer Stevens and Karen Burns. Before the trial, they withdrew their confessions and entered pleas of not guilty, because that happens more times than not.
Sure.
On June 12th of 1984, the Carsons were convicted first of Barnes's murder and sentenced to 25 years in prison. They were convicted of the murders of Stevens and Hellyer, for which they received sentences of 50 years to life and 75 years to life, respectively. In 1989, the First District Court of Appeal affirmed the third conviction as it had previously done on the other two convictions. Michael is incarcerated at Mule Creek State Prison, and Susan is incarcerated at Central California Women's Facility. In a five-hour interview, the San Francisco Chronicle, as well as homicide investigators, the Carsons claim to have been pacifist and vegan yoga practitioners who converted to a form of Islam and described themselves as vegetarian Muslim warriors. What the actual hell does that have to do with anything?
Do you get an outfit or like a suit or something that says, I am a vegetarian Muslim warrior? I'm sure there's a headpiece. Is there anything else?
It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Sounds cool as fuck.
It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
What are you? Bitch, I'm a vegetarian Muslim warrior. Okay.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Go ahead and pick up a hamburger. Go ahead. See what happens.
Their crimes emerged from a shared mission to exterminate individuals they believe to be witches.
Is that even part of the fucking Muslim religion or a vegetarian belief?
No, that's why I'm like, it doesn't have anything to do with anything.
The witches gotta go.
It doesn't have anything to do with anything.
I'm fucking vegetarian and Muslim.
And because of this, that's why the press dubbed them the San Francisco Witch Killers. They stated that they killed Barnes because they believed she had made a false conversion to their religion and was draining Miss Carson of her health and yogic powers. Okay, well, wait a minute. That wouldn't be a witch. That'd be an energy vampire.
What are yogic powers? What powers do you get?
I have that you don't. The bendy powers. I mean,
I think most women who do yoga come out with a nice ass and a firm tummy, but
that's it.
I mean, I guess those are powers in themselves, but I don't know how that could be drained from somebody, because if you're still doing the yoga, I don't know. This seems real dumb. I don't understand how two people are talking the same language.
They can't be quite right in the head.
They're just talking the same, like, Yeah, that makes sense. Like, I got yogi powers because I'm a vegetarian Muslim warrior. That bitch is draining my power.
That would be an energy vampire, if anything. It wouldn't be a witch.
Jesus Christ. Well, let me tell you what. The best energy vampires are mother-in-law, so those are the best fucking energy vampires. I'll just put out there.
You know what? I can wholeheartedly agree on that.
Yeah.
Yes. Their justifications for the second and third killings were that Stevens had allegedly sexually assaulted Suzanne. Well, didn't her yogic powers keep her safe? And that Hellyer had allegedly called her a witch and sexually abused her. From their...
I think they're prejudiced against witches.
It's just, that's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. From their conviction and through their incarceration up to 2017... they have shown no remorse for their crimes. Well, of course not, because they killed witches that sexually assaulted and stole their yogic powers.
Wow. I don't understand how two people get together and they not went over this stuff, but then they're like, yeah, that totally sounds great.
Well,
like, okay, yeah, so we are. Oh, yeah, you know what? We are vegetarian Muslim warriors with yogic powers. Wow. I didn't know you were one, too. Jesus Christ.
They claim to have traveled through Europe and back in the United States through the American Southwest and parts of California. The pair said they kept a list of targeted individuals, including political figures and celebrities such as Reagan and Johnny Carson.
Oh, okay.
According to Richard D. Reynolds, who wrote a book about the case, the Carsons were suspects in nearly a dozen other deaths in the U.S. and Europe. They probably... honestly got the idea while traveling in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if it's an interesting story, and like I said, there's not much on it, but we thought it's not really talked about that much. You want to know more about it, there is
there's a book
it's called Cry for War. The Carson story has also been in several of the true crime documentaries.
TV anthologies.
Yeah, Deadly Women, Wicked Attraction, The Devil You Know, Serial Killer in the Family, Snapped, Killer Couples. So, I mean, it has been covered in a lot of different type of medias, but we just thought it was interesting. There is another couple that is a little bit more popular that we had talked about doing. It's the... Carla Homolka, also known as Leanne Teal. She was a Canadian serial killer and rapist who, with her first husband Paul Bernardo, raped and killed at least three minors between 1990 and 1992. They were called the Ken and Barbie killers.
Ken and Barbie.
And really, just when we go over some of the details of it, they're just horrible, horrible people. Homolka did attract worldwide attention.
The Canadian ones?
Yes. When she was convicted of manslaughter following her plea bargain to serve only 12 years and the rape and murder of two Ontario teenage girls. That was Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French. As well as the rape and death of her own fucking sister.
Oh, yeah, because he didn't like how when they got together she wasn't a virgin. And he really wanted her to be a virgin, and she's like, he got attracted to the little sister, so she set it up for him to rape the little sister. Like, she knocked her out or something, and then she woke up during, and then they killed her.
Right. Bernardo was convicted of the murders, all the murders, and received life in prison, and a dangerous offender designation, the full maximum sentence allowed in Canada. You know what? Canada didn't have it right. They should have just put bullets in their heads. Homolka stated to investigators that Bernardo had abused her and that she had been an unwilling accomplice to the murders. As a result, she struck a deal with prosecutors for the reduced prison sentence of 12 years in exchange for a guilty plea to the charge of manslaughter. Homolka scored a 5 out of 40 on the psychopathy checklist, in contrast to Bernardo's 35 out of 40.
Well, he was actually doing stuff before they got together, wasn't he?
Yeah, but however, the videotapes of the crime surfaced after the plea bargain and demonstrated that Homolka was more than an active participant. She was very involved. As a result, the deal she had struck with prosecutors was dubbed the Canadian and the Canadian press deal with the devil.
Yeah, because they can't do jack shit to her.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was just a big public outcry, too, of just, like, what the fuck? Like, you know, why can't we go back? And, well, you can't. I mean, the deal's already been made.
Right.
She upheld her part. And so she did probably worse stuff to these people than Bernardo.
Yeah, she tried to put it all on him, and then the videotape surfaced, and yeah, she didn't play such a submissive role in it as she tried to lead people to think she did.
Well, here's a fucked up thing. When she was released, she married the brother-in-law of her lawyer, and I guess returned to Quebec.
I'm sure Canada was thrilled.
As far as her victims, during the summer of 1990, this is according to Homolka, Bernardo became attracted to her younger sister. Homolka hatched a plan to frame Bernardo for drugging Tammy, seeing an opportunity to minimize risk, take control, and keep it all in the family, so to speak.
Right.
Fucking gross. In July, according to Bernardo's testimony, he and Carla served Tammy a spaghetti dinner spiked with Valium. Carla actually stole that from where she was working.
Of course she did.
Bernardo raped Tammy for about a minute before she started to wake up. Homolka had also stolen anesthetic from a veterinarian clinic where she had worked. After the Homolka Christmas party, Bernardo and Carla drugged Tammy with the animal tranquilizers. Bernardo and Carla then raped, so she raped her own sister. Tammy later choked on her own vomit and died. Before calling 911, they hid the evidence, redressed Tammy, who had a chemical burn on her face, and moved her into the basement bedroom. A few hours later, Tammy was pronounced dead.
How are they going to explain the chemical burn on her face?
I don't know. It's fucking gross. Without having regained consciousness, Bernardo told police he tried to revive her but failed, and her death was ruled an accident. Citing the need to protect Bernardo's right to a fair trial, a politician ban was imposed on Homolka's preliminary inquiry. The Crown had applied for the ban, imposed on July 5th, 1993. Homolka, through her lawyer, supported the ban, where Bernardo's lawyers argued that he would be prejudiced by the ban since Homolka previously had been portrayed as a victim. Some lawyers argued that the rumors could be doing more damage to the future trial process than the publication of the actual evidence. Public access of the internet effectively nullified the court order, however, as did proximity to the Canada-US border, since the publication ban by an Ontario court cannot apply in New York, Michigan, or anywhere else outside of Ontario. I don't know. The plea bargain controversy. Jamie Cameron, the professor of law at Osgoode Hall, noted that at the time of Homolka's trial, three features of the case worried and concerned the public. Little was known about the respective roles of Homolka and Bernardo, and what it played in their actions and the killing of their victims. By 1993, it was clear that the Crown's case against Bernardo depended on Homolka's evidence. In terms to secure this conviction against him, her story had to be believed. So this is all a fucking conspiracy.
Right.
I mean, they needed her to tell this story so they could convict him, and they dubbed him the bigger monster. They both should have went to the fucking... They both should have got the max. On May 18th, 1983, Homolka was arraigned on two counts of manslaughter. Bernardo was charged with two counts of kidnapping, unlawful confinement, aggravated sexual assault, and first-degree murder, as well as one of dismemberment, coincidentally. That day, Bernardo's original lawyer, Ken Murray, first watched the rape videotapes. Good.
That's just the dumbest thing ever. I understand why I don't understand, but they did it for trophies so that they could go back and look at it.
Jesus.
And watch it. But do they not take into consideration for a second that you're leaving evidence?
I mean, whatever happened to, I mean, yeah, it's an experience that you're sharing together, but what, I mean, just, can you go hiking? I mean.
Yeah, what happened to that?
Hey, let's just, you know, let's have a nice memory. Let's go hiking.
Or go fucking walk on the beach.
You know what? Or yeah, let's go do something fun.
Or if you're looking for something that you've never done before with somebody, travel.
Yeah, travel. You don't have to murder. You don't have to rape. You don't have to do those things.
What the hell is wrong with somebody that they did this to their own little sister?
I mean, so this had to be, I think this had to be in her already.
Well, it had to be.
Because no person who's never thought of that is going to be like, yeah, you know what? Let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. No. Normal people don't think of that shit. Murray decided to hold on to the tapes and use them to impeach Homolka on the stand during Bernardo's trial.
Well, they already gave her.
I know. But this is, I don't know if it was just this a last-ditch effort to save his client, but he's on there doing the same shit.
It's probably like, he probably did that to show everybody, hey, you effed up by giving this person immunity when she's just as bad, if not worse, than the person you actually got on trial.
Well, Murray said the videotape showed Homolka sexually assaulting 4 female victims, having sex with a female prostitute in Atlantic City, and at another point, drugging an unconscious victim. In 1994, Homolka divorced Bernardo. During the summer of 94, Murray had become concerned about serious ethical problems that had arisen in connection with the tapes and his continued representation of Bernardo. He consulted his own lawyer, who asked the Law Society of Canada for their advice. The Law Society directed Murray in writing to seal the tapes in a package and turn them over to the judge presiding in the Bernardo trial. Murray said in a statement, Bernardo's counsel, and to tell Bernardo what he had been instructed to do, and that's what Murray had said in a statement. The revelation that a key piece of evidence had been kept from the police for so long created a furor, especially when the public realized that Homolka had been Bernardo's willing accomplice and not somebody who was forced because she was abused herself. Actually, some of this was her idea.
Well, he did actually beat her, because there was there was an instance where he severely beat her with a flashlight. And she probably used that as a stepping stone, I guess, like the groundwork for the "I was abused, he made me do this stuff," the story to get her the immunity.
Bernardo had always claimed, though, that he did rape and torture these girls, but it was actually Homolka who killed them.
So she was actually the one that killed. Is that evidenced on the tape that she was the one that killed everybody?
Nobody. Well, there's only been a few people that seen the tape, and they're not releasing the details.
Well, they probably can't because there's a gag order.
Right.
And there's probably a gag order because they don't want to look stupider than they already do by giving her immunity.
Right. After her 1995 testimony against Bernardo, when Homolka returned to the Kingston's prison for women, her mother, Dorothy Homolka, started to suffer an annual breakdown between Thanksgiving and Christmas. The collapse was severe enough that she was hospitalized, sometimes for months at a time.
Well, yeah, because your oldest daughter killed your youngest daughter.
While at Kingston, Homolka began correspondence courses in sociology through nearby Queen's University, which initially caused a media storm. Homolka was required to pay off fees as well as her personal needs from her fortnightly income of about $69. Although she told author Stephen Williams in a subsequent letter, "I did get some financial assistance." So, hey, you know what? You're in prison. We're going to pay for your education.
Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah.
News of Homolka's educational efforts were greeted in the media with disdain. Nothing has changed. Concepts of remorse, repentance, shame, responsibility, and atonement have no place in the universe of Carla. Perhaps she simply lacks the moral gene. see, in 1999, Toronto Star reporter Michael Shepard came into possession and copies of her application to transfer, and was published, and then published the story noting the halfway house's proximity to local schools hours before the Canadian courts issued a publication ban on the information. So they were going to move her to a halfway house to serve out the rest of her sentence in the proximity of schools. And,
yeah, because she's not a sexual predator or anything.
And in the halfway house, you can just sign yourself out as long as you return.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand the outrage. I really can.
Yeah, she's out now, married with a kid.
Mm-hmm. And
he was up for parole in 2018, mm-hmm. I think. And within 30 minutes, they went ahead and denied his parole.
Which they should have, but this bitch shouldn't have been out either.
No, she shouldn't have been out. They should not have made the deal with her. That was like...
Get this. On April 19th of 2010, the Vancouver Sun reported that Mulca would be eligible to seek a pardon for her crimes.
Why? And how?
Just saying. Offenders convicted of first or second degree murder with indeterminate sentences cannot apply for a pardon due to the fact that their sentences are for life. But Mulca was convicted of manslaughter and received less than the maximum life sentence, making her eligible. If she had been successful, her criminal record would not have been erased, but it would have been covered up in background checks.
Except
those required for working with children or other vulnerable people. Jesus.
Yeah, but that was kind of a very publicized thing. So she would have to legit change her name for anybody to not know who she is.
That's terrible. What the fuck's going on in Canada? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, she's a piece of shit. She's just as bad as he is, and she should still be sitting in jail just like him. It's not okay that she's out with a kid.
Then there's more couples like this, and I think we talked before we started this, even, you know, people who are married and the, you know, one spouse is a killer while the other one is not, the spouse that's not usually goes along with it, you know, because it's not them getting beat. It's not them getting tortured.
Right.
It's not them, you know, and so they almost feel like they need to do this so it's kept off of them. It's a survival thing.
They're just as guilty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're complicit. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I just don't understand how, like, is it fate just bringing these two types of people together?
It must be, or it could just be that these men are able, because it's surprising how often these men can find women. It's like they sniff them out.
Vulnerable.
To find the vulnerable.
The ones that need acceptance and
right.
do anything to get that acceptance.
Right. That they find them and then they make them do whatever they want them to. No matter what it is.
Yeah, it was like that. I think, what was it? Susan Stan? Was that the one? She was kidnapped with the whole family in the car and she was handcuffed and then a box put over her head. And she was called the girl in the box, and she was...
No, she wasn't the whole... I don't think... Yeah, it was, because it was the husband, the wife, and they had a baby. And that's why she was hitchhiking. I can't remember what her name was, but I know who you're talking about. She was hitchhiking, and she got into the car because she thought it was safe. Because there was a woman and a baby in the car with him. And what had happened was, is they put, like, a... it was a box they put over her head... but it was like a, it cut off sunlight, it cut off sound, and it was connected with like a padlock.
It's not Susan Stan, Colleen Stan.
Yeah, is this the same one that had to live in a box underneath the bed?
Basically, and see, the reason I'm bringing this up is because, you know, she went along, she was married to this guy, they had the family in the car, so, Colleen Stan is the name of the person that was kidnapped. So, she was born in December 31st, 1956. She was kidnapped and held as a sex slave by Cameron and Janice Hooker in their Red Bluff, California home over 7 years between 77 and 84. At Cameron Hooker's trial, Stan's experience was described as unparalleled in FBI history. Her case had received international publicity, subject to multiple books, films, and television series. So, in 77, Colleen Stan was hitchhiking from her home in Eugene, Oregon. She was going to a friend's house in Northern California. It was a birthday party, I believe. Cameron Hooker, who was born in November of 53, kidnapped 20-year-old Stan after picking her up. Stan stated she was an experienced hitchhiker, whatever the fuck that means. I guess it was considered safer back then.
Yeah, back then it was considered safer. And actually, the safest place to do this at the time was in Europe, because you had to do, like, permits, and you had to fill out applications. And even the people that picked you up did. They had to have stickers in their car, like on their windshield, that said they were able to collect hitchhikers, and they could only pick up hitchhikers if they had a matching card.
Well, according to Colleen, she had allowed two rides to go by because she was an experienced hitchhiker and didn't feel right.
Right.
But she felt confident climbing into this blue van because there was the wife, Janice. But there was also a baby. When they stopped at a gas station along the way, Stan went in to use the restroom. And she said, a voice told me to run and jump out of the window and never look back. Now that we talked about that earlier.
Wait, another one, yeah.
You know,
when you get that fight or flight, go.
She recalled, but she claimed her fears. She claimed she calmed her fears and went back to the car. According to Stan and Janice Hooker's testimonies, once they were alone in an isolated area, Hooker pulled off the highway and put a knife to Stan's throat. She was locked in a wooden head box and that was designed to prevent light, sound, and fresh air from entering. Now, the pictures of this box show, I mean, it was a crudely made box with padlocks, hinges. It was lined with heavy egg crate foam.
But here's
and it was a heavy box. I mean, it was a wooden.
Yeah, it would have been. It would, like, weighed at her shoulders and stuff. But since fresh air can't get into that, wouldn't she have suffocated?
I guess there was enough.
Because of the carbon monoxide that is.
But there was enough because it was foam, and there was obviously not an enclosed all the way. I mean, there's got to be holes and stuff, so it wasn't enough to suffocate her. But sure enough, probably to make it uncomfortable.
Well, sure. I would imagine so, because you're not putting her in a head box for comfort. Before this, Hooker actually worked at a lumber mill worker. And Janice had reached an agreement that he could capture a slave to take Janice's place.
Let's stop there. To take Janice's place.
Right.
So he was doing this to Janice.
Yeah, because he was...
When she said, hey, motherfucker, why don't we just get somebody else? Like, I'll be
all
right.
Because he was into, like, the bondage stuff.
Right, which
her
is
not
okay.
So much. And I think his was the extreme.
Right.
And she just wasn't into it. And she's like, look, why don't you just go ahead and get somebody else? But I'll be okay with it. Because, like we were saying, up until that time, Cameron had been using Janice to act out his sexual bondage fantasies. And she just was not into it. There was no penetrative sex with Stan, according to the agreement. But, big surprise, that later changed.
Well, and on the first night, I guess, of Stan's kidnapping, she was strung up by her hands, so she's hanging from her hands in a rafter in the basement, apparently. She was physically attacked by Cameron Hooker, which probably means she was beaten with whips, cat of nine tails, punches, slaps.
Oh, yeah.
And then she was left blindfolded and suspended while the pair had sex right below her.
So that means that I'm assuming they had, like, normal sex. Because he got the violent part out of his system on her, which means the wife didn't have to deal with the violent part.
Correct. And it, per her part of the agreement,
she would have the sex with him as long as he did all the hard shit to the slave.
Right. After her kidnapping, Stan stated she was tortured and kept locked in a box 23 hours a day until she was giving her a contract, and she was forced to sign herself into slavery for life. In view from the box under the bed propped against her purse, Stan told ABC 10 News she was a photo of Stan. A photo Stan saw every day of Marie Elizabeth Spanhawk, a previous victim whose body was never found. So, motivation to shut the fuck up, I guess.
And they made her look at that picture?
Yes. Like, that's the only thing she could see from the box she was locked in. She further stated that Cameron led her to believe that she was being watched by a large, powerful organization called The Company.
And what is this? This is not the only guy that said this.
No, and it's... there is a conspiracy that there is something like that, but it's also brainwashing. It's you know, over time you hear that enough, you begin to believe it. You know, torture is not about pain or anything like that, right? I mean, we've heard that many times from people who are experienced, like CIA interrogators. It's mm-hmm. time.
Oh yeah.
And breaking,
in isolation.
And breaking someone of a routine. But this. The company, I guess, what he told her, would painfully torture her and harm her family if she tried to escape. Stan subsequently became a slave, referred to as Kay, and was forced to call Cameron master, and was not allowed to talk without permission. Cameron reportedly wanted Stan to be like the female character in the 1954 French erotic novel Story of O, and soon started raping her, which consisted of oral sex, vaginal sex, and that breached his agreement with his wife, which I guess pissed her off. Instead, he raped her vaginally and anally with implements. Following this, the Hooker family moved to a mobile home in Red Bluff with Stan, where she was kept locked in a wooden box underneath the couple's waterbed. In 1978, Janice gave birth to a second child on the waterbed above Stan. That's fucked
up. Gross.
That is fucked up. Stan said that her faith in God and belief in chance of escape helped her survive. Her greatest fear, however, was what was reinforced daily by Cameron, that the company would get a hold of her family, and she wanted to avoid painful punishments. Stan tried to comply with his commandments, which he called, that was his list of commandments, which later led to her being allowed to go out to jog, work in the yard, care for the family's children in the mobile home, and help him build bigger accommodations, like an underground dungeon for more slaves.
Jesus.
Even with an open door, neighbors, and a telephone, she made no attempt to escape. According to Stan, her fear of the company kept her from seeking help.
That's just... because how long has he had her up until this point?
I think at some point, though, prosecution or authorities was really kind of baffled, and they was almost thinking she was... compliant with this, like this.
No, I mean think about it, you're locked in a box for 23 hours a day for who knows how long, and at some point being locked up like that in the dark by yourself, not being able to use the bathroom, I mean, you're doing it on yourself, there's no other way. At some point, you're going to start doing whatever you have to.
To survive.
To survive.
Right. And, you know, to not be in uncomfortable
situations.
It's kind of like being in prison. You become institutionalized.
And then if you hear something repeatedly, and you have evidence that he's killed other people, because he's making you look at these pictures, and you're hearing the story of, well, they tried to escape, so the company got him, and all this stuff. At some point, you're going to start believing it.
Yeah, and you're not going to ask too many questions.
Right.
You're going to get fucking beat that night.
And you're going to do everything you can to keep yourself safe in the hopes, because it's always going to be in the back of your mind, there's going to be a time that I can get out of here.
And scarily enough, you look at these pictures, they look like normal fucking people. And they look like normal people.
And then you're going to do everything you can, too, to protect your family.
Right. I can get where she would comply. I mean, I understand totally. Additionally, though, Stan was allowed to visit her family by herself in 1981, but she did not reveal her situation. She did not reveal any kind of, you know, help me, I need help, this is where I'm at, because she feared the possible consequences. Her family thought she was involved in a cult, because of her homemade clothes, lack of money, absence of communications over the years. They didn't want to pressure her, fearing that she would stay away forever.
Well, that's typical. I mean, I could understand because this is, what, 81? Cults are getting really...
ramped up.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, are we learning more about them? I think they've been around for...
Right, but you're hearing more about them. And, I mean, that's what they would look like.
Well, I guess the next day, Stan returned for a second visit with Hooker posing as her boyfriend. At the trial, Stan explained that she was happy about visiting her family, who were therefore able to take a photograph of her and Cameron smiling happily together. And I think that was the other thing that authorities were kind of... because there was a picture of them together smiling.
Okay, yes, but again, it does not matter. You're being told that while you're there, this mysterious group is watching you to make sure you behave yourself.
Right.
Because if you do not, they will come in there and kill you all.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally get it. I mean, it's... She had to comply.
She had to.
In her mind, this is real.
Yeah, because again, you don't know how many people they've done this to. I think even to this day, you don't know how many people they've done this to.
According to Stan, Hooker feared he had given his slave too much freedom and took her back to his mobile home where he locked her in the wooden box under his bed, and she remained in the box 23 hours a day for the next 3 years. Bodily functions were dealt with by her using a bedpan, which she positioned under herself with her feet, and was stated in court, Hooker's children were told Kay had gone home. However, once his children had gone to bed, Hooker would take Stan out of the box to feed and then torture her. She was reportedly not allowed to make any noise. She had to lie still 23 hours at a time in the dark with little air to breathe. During the summers, conditions were especially harsh on her, as the temperatures in the box would rise over 100 degrees. To feed herself, she ate the scraps of food left over from the family.
And just think about it. You're in a box under a waterbed, which is heated. Because yep. There's stuff that lays underneath, like in between the base of the bed and then the plastic thing that all the water's in.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. I mean, I can't even...
And she didn't do anything wrong. She did everything he told her to. But because he let her see her family 2 days in a row, she gets put back in the box.
It was too much freedom. Too much freedom. And I think that was part of his sadist, it was part of the mind fuck of it all, was part of his abuse, was part of his thing. That's what got him off. You know, the mind fuck. I can control her mentally, physically, sexually, spiritually. I control all of that. It's almost like he was her god. And that's what he wanted. And then, you know, the biggest mind fuck up at all was, well, you know, she signed this contract, so, you know, she wanted this. She wanted to do it. You gotta be a special kind of fucked up to do something like that to somebody. I mean, you gotta be. That's shit that, you know, people who are trying to interrogate people do. They do shit like that to get information.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's doing it for fun and for kicks.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's right under any circumstance, but, you know, I mean, there's probably certain times that it's called for to get vital information out of somebody you need to save other lives. He's doing it for fucking kicks.
Yeah, he's legitimately doing it to get off.
And knowing she's under the bed, how can the wife be okay with that? You're fucking...
Because...
And the girl that he's sexually involved with, too, is underneath you. How is that okay?
Because she gets the rough part of it while the wife gets the nice part of it. That's how she's looking at it. I mean, he's got her just as messed up. He's got the wife just as messed up as the girl in the box. I mean, think about it. Think about how long she dealt with the same torture that this girl's dealing with, to where she finally just said, look, just get somebody else to do this too. I'm not going to care. Just please do this.
I guess out of desperation, maybe?
Yeah. Because she may have been afraid that, look, he's going to kill me. Because clearly he's killed other people. Like, other slaves that he's taken in, he killed. Mm-hmm. So, the wife's just like, I got to do whatever I can to stay alive.
Well, it's hard to say what you would do in that situation.
I think in that situation...
I certainly wouldn't do what Cameron Hooker did. I certainly wouldn't be okay being the partner of somebody who's doing that to somebody. You know, I just can't imagine this poor woman. How's she not fucked up for life?
I did. It was actually not until 1983 that Stand was reintroduced to the children and neighbors. She was also allowed at this point in time to get a job as a maid at a motel. Hooker wanted Stan to become his second wife, which was a turning point for Janice.
So she was going to get a promotion.
Yeah.
So, you know what I think? I think Janice at this point thought, oh, well,
that's not what we agreed on.
Well, not only that, the abuse is going to come back to me now.
Well, no, I don't think that's... I don't think that's what it was. I think it was...
You think it was
rivalry? Yeah, exactly. Really? Yeah, because...
Jealousy over this guy?
Yeah, well...
What do you have, a horse cock?
She agreed for him to do this, but the agreement was you take a slave, but when you're done, get rid of her and get a new one. He wasn't supposed to get emotionally attached to these slaves. And in her mind, he's now emotionally attached to this person... So that's not okay. That wasn't the agreement. Huh. Janice confessed that starting with their first date, she had also been tortured, brainwashed, and referred to as a whore over the years by Cameron. Janice further stated that she survived their relationship by engaging in denial and
compartmentalization.
Thank you. By August of 84, Janice began struggling with herself and went to Stan in order to inform her that Hooker was not part of the company. However, she maintained that the organization did exist.
Okay, so maybe there's truth to it, or maybe she really believes it.
But she's saying this organization is real, but we are not a part of it. So, asshole's been lying to you the whole damn time. In a televised interview for Girl in the Box, Stan told the interviewer that she then went to a bus station and phoned Hooker to inform him that she was leaving him and that he reacted by bursting into tears. Stan subsequently caught a bus home. In the months that followed, she did not contact the police but continued to call Hooker regularly. That's messed up. She explained this at the trial by saying that she wanted to give Hooker, at Janice's request, a chance to reform. 3 months later, Janice reported her husband to the police. She informed Lieutenant Jerry D. Brown of the Red Buff Police that Cameron had kidnapped, tortured, and murdered Marie Elizabeth
Spanhawk.
Spanhawk, who had disappeared on January 31st of 1976. Authorities were unable to locate the remains of the woman. Due to the lack of physical proof, no murder charge was brought. And you don't know if he had done this before he met Janice. Because
Maybe it's something he told her.
Well, no, she witnessed it. But that doesn't mean she knew where the body was at. Do you think he's going to show her where that body's at? And I don't think this is something he just... Because the box was already ready for the head. This was stuff he already had in place. He already knew what he was going to do because...
He already had plans. He already built stuff. It was premeditated.
Well, the thing is that this isn't the first time he's done it. I don't even think this girl was his second. This is something he has been doing to have it down to know how to do it, what to do...
Because it was pretty smooth, really.
It was pretty smooth.
And he knew having the baby there was...
Yeah. She's not his second go-around. He's been doing this. And I think he didn't do this with Janice because she was okay with everything. So he just decided to keep her and then continue with the slaves.
Chris Hatcher, a forensic psychologist and criminal profiler, testified for Cameron's prosecution at the start of the 85 trial. Janice testified against her husband in exchange for full immunity. In the end, Hooker was sentenced to consecutive prison terms totaling 104 years for the sexual assaults, kidnapping, and using a knife in the process. Originally ineligible for parole until 2023, he had his hearing date moved up 7 years to 2015 by California's Elderly Parole Program. You know what?
Who cares?
He didn't fucking cut this staying any slack. Get in the box, bitch.
Right.
Fucking beat her.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Didn't cut her any slack at all. And I kind of feel bad for Janice, too. I really do.
Okay, she was in a no-win situation.
I think she should have served some time. But I do feel like that in the end...
She did the right thing by telling her, look, he's lying to you. You can leave.
Right. On April 16th, 2015, his request for parole was denied, and Hooker will be eligible for having another hearing in 2030. Get this. However, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, California officials contacted Stan and advised that her that they were looking to possibly grant him parole in 2021.
In March. Yeah, that this
Jesus
year.
Jesus Christ. Let him fucking die from it. Who cares?
Yeah, who cares how bad it is in California right now? I don't understand why this is something else. I don't understand why we give a shit. Why? I understand COVID-19's bad. You know how bad it is because you're out there dealing with it every day. Every day you're bathing in this shit.
Right.
So, you know how bad it is. You've seen it at its worst and you've seen it...
Oh, I've seen it run through 30 people and kill them.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen how the low end of it, you've seen the high end of it. But what I do not understand is why we give a flying fuck about these criminals in jail for murder. Who cares if they get it?
Fuck that. You know what I say?
That's less money people have to pay
for
them.
I say we fucking experiment on them. Hey, you know what? Let's give you COVID-19, see if you survive it. Let's see what works. Let's see what it does to people.
Who cares?
Fuck him. Yeah, I mean, he's a piece of shit.
And they're trying to... Bill Cosby's doing the same fucking thing. Hey, there's COVID-19. Let me out. And Weinstein tried to do that, too.
After the trial, Stan studied for an accounting degree. She tried to move on to a normal life, but misery followed her. A string of failed marriages... and a troubled child now in jail. Stan also joined and volunteered for Reading Women's Refuge Center. That's an organization that helps abused women. Janice reverted to her maiden name, became a registered associate social worker, and has worked as a mental health professional. Stan has changed her last name and continues to live in California.
Janice and Stan continue.
Yeah, but they do not communicate with each other.
I can explain. I can understand why they wouldn't.
The only thing that you got in common is that piece of shit. So why the fuck would you want to relive that? That's just horrible. I mean, and the fact that, you might, get COVID, so we're going to let you out due to this pandemic. Fuck that. Really? Nobody cut her slack.
Right.
Jesus Christ. If you get a chance, go online and look at the box he built for this person. This is just, it's terrible. It breaks your heart. That a human being had to be subject to that. And you can only imagine, and I know you want to point the finger at Janice, it seems like, yeah, she made the call at the end.
Of the groups that we've done today, of the serial killer couple groups that we've done today, she, I think, is the only one of the group that could be as much a victim as the victims themselves. Because she didn't actively have any part in it like the other women did. She was going along with it to spare herself. But eventually came to realize, hey, this is never going to stop. He's just going to keep doing this. And he went against what they agreed upon with this situation.
I gave him an inch and he took a mile.
Exactly. And he developed feelings for this girl. Now he wants to have a second wife. And then we're just going to have to go through this all again until eventually I become the person in the box and he kills me.
Right.
Because that's probably what was running through her head, that he's going to replace me with Stan and then he's going to kill me and then he's just going to keep going.
Which it seems like he was no stranger to murder. I agree with you. He seemed organized. He seemed like...
Just like Parker Ray.
Organized. I know what I need. I know what I want. I know how to do it. And this is what's going to work. So... And I don't know, was there possibly a conversation that they had before this to say, this is the plan, this is how we're going to get me a slave. This is how, you know, and Janice is a willing participant in the conversation. Or was it, this is what you're going to do?
Yeah, because I think by the time he met her, he had probably already had a couple and killed a couple and was going to do the same thing to her, but realized, hey, I don't have to. She can be easily manipulated. I can keep her and then keep doing what I want. And he probably did it in a way to where it was her idea.
Well, being the piece of shit that he is, probably. So.
He probably somehow convinced her that it was her idea to get a sex slave. And this was the best thing to do for their marriage.
Look, you don't want me to do it to you, that's fine.
Yes.
But I need somebody to do this too. Well, motherfucker, do it to yourself.
Right.
If you like it so much. You know, I mean, that's... I mean, that's, to me... If you're really that dedicated to it, well, you got to bring your wife in on it. If she's not doesn't want to be a part of it, that's fine.
Because I mean, the last three that we did in this one, the women were active participants, even more so
than
the men.
I'm still on the fence with Janice. I'm still on the fence. I can understand the other points of view, but I'm still on the fence. I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, I had all this research and reading of these fucking killer couples. She does seem to be the least.
Killery.
Complicit, but at the same time, you know, you can't ignore the fact that she's sleeping on top of this bitch in a box. I mean,
well, I mean, how do you ignore?
She's
having
sex the first night.
She had a goddamn baby.
I don't.
On the bed above this chick.
And maybe that was a part of it too. Like, he'll kill me and the kids. I need to do this.
Right. Yeah. Because at that point, that was her second child, so she has to think. As horrible as it sounds, she has to think of her babies. I mean, she really does.
I mean, that's a tough... That'd be a tough spot for anybody to be in, wouldn't it?
Right. And, I mean, yes, you can say that she put herself in that situation because she did stay with him.
And there wasn't a whole lot of literature on how her relationship was with Stan in the house. You know, when Cameron wasn't around, was she good to Stan? Did she, you know... Because you have to feel for that other person. If you're not a complete psychopath like he is, you have to... I mean,
I think she was... as friendly as she could be.
Or did she close herself off because she had to?
Yeah, I mean, that probably happened too, which is what happens with a lot of these, because this is not the only instance of a married couple taking a slave. I mean, wasn't there another one where this girl taken and she lived in a tent on this property and the guy became batshit crazy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds, and, you know, just gross, nasty stuff. Like, what we do to each other is just fucking horrible. And anybody who feels sorry for Cameron is, they need to go join him in prison. That's just...
Oh, maybe they won't have to. Seems like he's going to get out in fucking March.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode. We enjoyed bringing you the information. Hopefully it wasn't too heavy for anybody, but...
Yeah.
You know, we didn't commit the crimes. We're just... reporting what happened.
So, yeah.
I mean, it disturbs us too, but
it really does.
I think the more information we have out there, the more we learn and the safer we can be.
Yeah.
So, have a good evening.
And if anybody has any ideas, feel free to email us at the cryptidkillers@yahoo.com. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll see you next time.
All right.
Bye.